So tonight's the, let's see, the waxing half moon of October. And so what that means by our Buddhist tradition, the calendar means that would be one more week before the end of the rains retreat, the traditional rains retreat, the Vasa. And wow, yeah, even just like I was saying a minute ago, just reflecting on, hadn't been in here for, you know, for an evening like this. I personally hadn't been in for a long time, and it just seems like time really, really has flown by. It seems like not that long ago that we were entering the rains retreat, and now we're, assuming we all live that long, we will exit the rains retreat next week. So, yeah, I'd be up at Harnam Monastery. I was leading I was invited to lead a short weekend retreat. They have a little retreat house called Kusala House. Maybe some of you have been there. And it's very lovely. I find very lovely space. I'd never led a retreat there. Last year I was there, I led a retreat, but we used the main hall up in the main monastery building, and the little retreat house has a what I find a very beautiful shrine room, quite small, very contained, very light. And in the end, with cancellations, there were only a dozen or so people on the retreat. And I personally, one of the reasons why I accept invitations to do things like that is A, I want to help. You know, people feel confident that I can lead those things, and I want to help out. And but secondly, what caught me off guard the first time I led a retreat was the perceived benefits that my own. You know, having to share Dhamma, to be able to try and speak clearly enough to convey what for me is the most important thing I can think of. And so having to clarify that in your mind and heart enough to convey that. And so, because the very first time, about 4 years ago, that I was asked if I would lead a retreat, Ajahn Anando, it came by him, Sunyata Retreat Center in Ireland, the teacher that was, or the person that was going to lead the retreat had to pull out at fairly short notice, a few weeks. It's not greatly short notice, but short notice. And my first response was, no, I can't do it. You know, all of a sudden, you know, all the reasons in the world to not do it came to mind and out of my mouth. So Ajahn Anando, I said, I'm too junior, I don't have experience and stuff. And he says, and I said, anyway, you know, I'd have to ask Ajahn Amaro. And he says, I already have. And I said, oh, what was the answer? He says, you should do it. So I said, well, I'm still going to ask Ajahn Amaro. So I went to Ajahn Amaro, and yes, indeed, that was there was encouragement there to pick it up. But around that time too, because you know, as most people know, we have our system of training. At least the way I see it is that, you know, we start out, you know, with certain duties and tasks when we're very junior, and then maybe as we get senior, maybe we do get asked to do things, you know, like, you know, lead a retreat or even sit up here, whatever. But I did notice a few years ago when that being asked to do things like that came up that I thought, okay, I'll say yes. You know, especially after that first experience with that retreat, I thought, well, just if it's somebody, obviously, you know, my teachers and mentors, you know, I trust them. I don't even have to ask if I trust them because I already do. Is to just say yes. Yes, I'll do that. And but there was this thing in my mind that said, oh, I'll expand my comfort zone. I'll expand my comfort zone. Comfort zone is at least in the English language, because it is English, is a quite a common phrase. It's been a common phrase for a long time. And presumably in the world it is. I don't know. It's that idea of being comfortable. That being comfortable, and it's fair enough, you know. On one level, we you know, as human beings or as living beings, comfort is considered good. It's comfortable, And it's more pleasant than being uncomfortable. And so I had this idea, okay, I'll just say yes, and then I can expand my comfort zone. And then what wasn't spoken but was hidden in the background, well, that I discovered later on, was it, okay, when I'm comfortable, I won't suffer. I won't suffer when there's comfort. And then I'll expand my comfort zone. But then a couple of years later, a year and a half later, I thought, well, wait a second. You know, it's like that chant that we do fairly frequently on the unconditioned. Is just getting a bigger comfort zone, is that unconditioned? Well, no. I mean, you don't have to think very long to figure out, well, no, that's just conditioned, another condition to grasp onto and to try and dwell in. And so I'll be born into happiness if I can get a big comfort zone. So that's been rumbling around, is, you know, for the last, you know, couple of years. It's something that, you know, from time to time I'll use for reflection, is that, you know, okay, well, so what's that, you know, because we there's so many teachings that we hear and we have contact with, the what's left behind, the Buddha's teachings handed down by tradition, and also, you know, people since then and present day now, so much teaching available, and so much, you know, at least in my own, what tends to pop up or really catch my ear and my eye is the teaching around, you know, the mind knowing the mind. The mind knowing the mind. Now that's one expression, like Ajahn Chah, the story of him finally meeting up with Lumpur Man, the great forest master in the last century. The way I'll probably get some of the details wrong in the little story, but basically Ajahn Chah had the desire, the wish to go and train with Lumpur Man, Ajahn Man. And so this would have been, I think Ajahn Man died in, I think, 1959, so I don't know what year it was, but it was quite a long time ago. And my understanding of Thailand is not very developed, but I understand there were very few roads, and it was quite an arduous, difficult task for Ajahn Chah, and I think he traveled with some other monks, I think, and then to try and find Ajahn Man. And that, if I recall, it took many months, and Ajahn Chah finally found Ajahn Man, and one of the teachings, it's in Food for the Heart. I think it's probably in quite a few books that we have in English of Ajahn Chah's teachings, but is it what really strikes me is this description of Ajahn Chah saying what really he took away from what he learned from Ajahn Man in those days. Because in the end, Ajahn Man said, oh, you can stay for 3 days. I mean, can you imagine walking all those many months and then getting there and then, oh, you can stay for 3 days. So, and what if one of the things was that when Ajahn Man said, oh, when you see the difference between mind and objects of mind, mind objects, then there's not much else you'll have to do. I might be paraphrasing a little bit that. So when you see the difference between mind and objects of mind, there isn't much more you'll have to do. So I remember reading that years ago, and it very much mirrored a phrase that I heard here. I was a layman. I used to come here a lot as a layman. And it was before the temple was built. I remember going to Dhamma talks, you know, frequently, sometimes 2 times a week. I would drive up from London. And I think it was Ajahn Viradamo giving the Dhamma talk. I'm pretty certain, but not 100%. And him saying that the mind that knows anger is not angry. And then he went down. He used a few examples. The mind that knows joy, you know, is not joy. So that which knows the quality or the state of mind is not that state of mind. And so when I read the Ajahn Man, Ajahn Chah exchange, to me, they just fold in. And then a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, I spent the winter back at Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California, where I became a monk. And there, I don't think it's the first time they've done that, but what they do is 6 days a week, they'll do Dhamma readings. except what they do is they'll start at the top of the line with Lumpur Pisano. He'll do a reading, and then the next day, the next monk, second monk, will give a reading. And it goes all the way down, including the two long-term residents, the full-time residents that live there, and then they'll start again. And then there's usually one theme chosen, at least to get it started. So the theme, the winter I was there, was it had to be teachings from a forest, from the Thai forest tradition. And it meant, and the limit was actually, it had to be Thai monks, Thai nuns, Thai lay, if there was a lay, like Upasaka Gi, lay person, lay woman. It had to fall within Thai. It couldn't be Thai forest tradition, but Ajahn Sumedho. And so we started and did a couple of cycles, and it was such a rich, everybody was finding it such a rich field for contemplation and readings that we just kept going straight through the whole winter retreat. But for me, what really stood out was how many different expressions of that sort of mind knowing the mind objects, different expressions in it, and so many of the teachings came from either from Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Mun disciples, and then Ajahn Chah disciples, Ajahn Buddhadasa, people like that. And these different expressions, and obviously these were all translated, but different expressions that my ear heard kept hearing over and over, that they fit. So that really makes me sit up and listen, just to my own sort of tendency. And so I contemplate that. I use this a lot. So it's, you know, that mind, so, or Lumpur Dun, you know, the mind seeing the mind. Okay, the mind seeing the mind. Now one could say, well, what does that mean, the mind seeing the mind? But here again, to use, these are reflective teachings. The Buddha's teachings, the way I understand it, it's a reflective tradition. And some traditions within the Buddhist tradition maybe focus more or less on using things on a more reflective way, or maybe, a little less reflective. But the way I see it, yes, it's reflective. So taking that, well, the mind seeing the mind. So I think it's Ajahn Beardamo uses, objects. Objects in awareness. So you say, well, what's an object? So we can look at material things, or the most obvious, so that this chair and this microphone, everything we see and that we can touch. You say, well, okay, that's an object, so it comes into my awareness. It's easy, but, and then you start maybe the things unseen, so things that are also maybe also very obvious. What we smell incense. You know, what we hear voice. We hear whatever. Those are also within our consciousness, within awareness. Those are the way that language is being considered or used, is that those are also objects of mind or objects in awareness. And then things that are, you know, maybe even more subtle, maybe not, are our thoughts and emotions, especially more subtle. Habits of thinking, habits of emotions that come up from experiences that we have every day. And so if we can also look at those as or consider them, at least in terms of reflection, as objects in awareness, or the mind seeing mind objects, the mind seeing the mind. So then we say, and here again, well, what is this mind? What is this awareness? So, and that's where, you know, I don't feel overly competent or, you know, particularly confident to talk about, because it's like, okay, awareness. What color is that? What shape is that? What size is that? Does it have, you know, show it to me, describe it. And that's why I like I've heard over and over again the expression in the Thai language, and forgive me, Thai speakers, if I get this wrong, but puru, which means, I think, the one who knows. And if I understand right, it's an epithet for the Buddha, the one who knows, with this knowing, the knowing quality. So, yes, here again, how do you describe that? We can describe objects, we can describe things and emotions, and emotions are a little bit more difficult because it has so much to do around just feeling tones and things like that. It's like, how do you describe anger? But how do you describe knowing? And so, using those as reflection. So for me, when I ask the question, okay, what is it that knows? What is that it's experience? It's not even an it. Even an it to me is a thing, is an experience of trying to know. And then you think, well, does it, okay, let's say you know, but what's the actual experience feel like? What's that like as an experience? If you can step back, and even stepping back to me has a limitation. There's a limit. There's almost like a boundary because you step back. But that broadness. And so these are all words here again, because language itself is conditioned. It's something that we use. It's used to describe things. And here again, everything we have, emotions, things, thoughts, whatever. But if it's still describing things. So I know one day I was leading a retreat, and I was talking, around this theme, but I said, to the big heart, which is not an expression that I made up. Obviously, I've heard this over and over again. The big heart. To enlarge in the heart so there's space to receive what comes our way, especially in the emotional realm. When we refer to heart, we're talking about the emotional world. I mean, oftentimes people might use mind as more the intellectual aspects of our being. And so I found myself, make it bigger. But here again, that's a condition. Bigger is just another condition. If I just make a bigger, it's like expanding my. If I get stuck in that repetitive thing of expanding my comfort zone, I'm just making the heart bigger. It's still a limit. It's limited. It's bound. And it's conditioned. And then here again, using language, one can try and, okay, let's think about that. So then that boundless was a word that came up, this boundless heart, boundless mind, limitless. So there is no boundary. Can it be that space, not just space as in a room, or space as in there's space in my heart for you, or there's space in my heart for this emotion or whatever, but more space in terms of contemplating, like, where is it, like, space in the bigger sense, like when the Buddha speaks about oftentimes he would talk about the four great elements of earth, fire, water, and air, but then sometimes he would also add in space and consciousness, which I find also a very useful reflection. So where does space end? Where does it end? Maybe when we were kids, I know when I was a kid, I used to lie outside. I used to sleep outside, actually, most of the summer. Where I lived in California was perfect for sleeping outside. And most of the nights were very, just clear sky every night till the fog rolled in at about 6 in the morning. So all night I could look up, I'd wake up, look up at the stars and ponder. I think probably most of us have done this. Okay, where does it end? Where does that end? Where does space? The book says they haven't found the edge. So it's that boundless space. Then you take the Buddha's saying, okay, consciousness. So is consciousness, as a question, is consciousness boundless? Is there a boundary? So is there space in consciousness for us to receive whatever comes our way? So comfort zone. So if I'm not worried about in the comfort zone or out of the comfort zone, can I just whatever comes in, okay, this is discomfort. And even this morning, Ajahn Amaro, he reminded us of Lumpur Sumedho's, you know, very used phrase, it's like this, so discomfort comes in. Oh, okay, here we are. This is discomfort. Okay, and then maybe you do something, oh, okay, this is within my comfort zone. Oh, this is comfortable. Comfort's like this. But sometimes we can like I know myself, is it, you know, I think, oh, well, okay, I'll just, it, I can, that numbs, that'll sort of numbify the actual emotion around the comfort or discomfort, as we say, like the pleasant feeling or unpleasant feeling. That, oh, it'll just make it so you, oh, I'm not feeling. This is how I've often picked it up myself, just even though I've heard the teaching or read the teaching, but still that little habit of going, oh, okay, and then I'll get used to it being like this, and then it won't hurt, or then I won't get grasping, I won't grasp the good stuff, the happiness, the pleasant, the joyful. But, oh, no, and it's that feeling, though, you know, that oh, yeah, I can feel that. Yeah, it feels like this, and it feels, that's pleasant. It's sweet. The sweetness of a pleasant experience, and then conversely, on the other end, that maybe something difficult comes our way, and then yeah, it's like this, but yeah, don't just because it's like this doesn't mean, or does it mean? I shouldn't even project what it should or shouldn't, but to ask the question: does that mean you're not going to feel it just because it's like this? No, it's. To me, at least in my own experience, you know, where I'm at now with this practice, because I really want to stress that this is, you know, even though I can talk about this, this is totally a work in progress. You know, just this is reflecting on practice and where how I'm working with this right now. So things come and go. So if in practice, if we can turn to that element or whatever word we can use to describe awareness, to have that boundless, the boundlessness, of awareness, of consciousness, things coming and going, feeling it, yeah. Human being, we have, you know, this is the package of, the way I see it, the package of being a human being, is that we have emotional responses to things, we have intellects, and they are, to me, they're obviously linked. You know, if I bring up a, you know, if a difficult memory comes up, or if I think of something difficult, yeah, I feel that. You know, so it's linked. It's linked. So when I'm able to do this, in these little micro moments of being able to do this, this one of the experiences I have is of fearlessness. It's, you know, I found one of the teachings around generosity, which I heard a number of years ago around the different types of generosity, and one that really really struck me that I had never contemplated was the gift of fearlessness. The gift of fearlessness, and so I often think about this, and sometimes when I've been in a situation where I'm sharing, I'll talk about it, and if I remember right, it's around also. Or around, if, for instance, if we live in a wholesome way in using the five precepts, and then if whether people know that or not, if they're around you long enough, they're probably going to pick up on some sort of trust, and it's that gift, they don't have to be in fear. There's a fearlessness around being around you. But one time I flipped it around and I thought, well, actually, when I live by precepts, I also don't live in fear. So this idea of fearlessness. And so when I have these moments of being able to receive, you know, difficult thoughts, difficult thought habits, patterns, whatever, maybe some stray thought comes up, and I'm just like, whoa, like, where did that come from? Like, don't want that. And then obviously emotions, the same thing. Is it when I have those moments of clarity, and that feels like this, there's a fearlessness. If this can be developed, if this can be where it's not micro moments, then what's to be afraid of in terms of experience as a human being? Because so much of my life has been spent trying to control, trying to create the comfort zone, stay in the comfort zone, not be out of the comfort zone too soon. So it's that controlling. But if I don't, if inside outside comfort zone is okay, then this feeling of fearlessness, comes up, that I don't need to control. I don't need to control my experience. Of course, we should control to a degree. But if we're constantly sort of barricading ourselves or shying away, you know, obviously I want to control the use of my precepts as a bhikkhu, of course. Obviously, I want to control my, you know, my body, speech, and mind, actions of body, speech, and then what I think to a degree. But how much of our life is it can be controlled? You know, throw that as a question. If we think, you know, we can get everything lined up, and then everything goes differently, or things go differently. Not everything, but things go differently. So taking away that need to control, to overly control our life, so that we don't, you know, we barricade or we protect ourselves from that, the randomness of life. This feeling of, as I mentioned a minute ago, the word fearlessness comes up. So then, you know, if the heart is boundless, if the mind is boundless. It doesn't, you know, the way I work with it doesn't mean I don't do anything. You know, it's like if something comes into the mind, a stray thought, that you know, okay, do you want to follow this? So a lot of my own practice is around asking questions, asking the question. You know, when something really becomes prominent enough to see that's not something to be developed, not something to be hung on to at all. Yeah, I'll ask the question, like, okay, do you want to follow this? Do you want to pursue this? Or the other phrase I use is, okay, choose. Ahimsa go, choose. You got a choice here. And so that's the way I, you know, the in terms of developing mindfulness, is that ability to see, you know, that really getting to know our own minds and hearts, our own habits, habitual, especially habitual things of reacting to things, but just also just seeing whatever comes in. So yes, we sit on cushions and we do walking meditation or lying meditation, whatever, standing meditation. We do these things. We develop mindfulness. And so that's, you know, especially in the formal aspects, but, and then, you know, turning that into that 20, it is the 24/7 practice, though, of being able to see clearly, to see what comes up. So when we're going about our day, whatever we're doing. And then, oh, okay. So for me, I take a walk every day. I try to go, I mean, virtually every day I take a walk. About an hour, and The mind sometimes, not sometimes, it's thinking away, doing pondering and cogitating and all sorts of things. And oftentimes that's when things will bubble up quite strong or whatever time of the day, and just asking that question, okay, you have a choice. Choose wisely, whatever phrase, on that theme. But when we're not mindful, as my own experience is that I miss it, and boy, it hits. And I can be, if I'm out walking, you can get to the end of your walk and 55 minutes of dukkha, of stress, of just the mind gnawing away. But if we can see it and just feel it and go, okay, and then the experience I have when I do notice is that seeing, that's that actual experience of seeing, is that even if the object of mind is still there, it somehow loses power. It's kind of a miraculous, I think a miraculous thing, that it somehow loses its power. And to me, that just totally folds into the Buddhist teachings, the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness, and the third foundation of Cittanupassana, so objects of, or is often translated as objects of mind or mind. So the Buddha's instructions to, and he goes through, different emotions will come up, seeing an angry mind, it's just like, okay, breathing in, you see the angry mind is angry mind. Full stop. So to me, that's the mind seeing mind objects, the mind seeing the mind. And then that, I can only describe my own experience when I do notice this. So, the other night, or the other day up at Harnam, on retreats, I don't tend to offer talks as such. I tend to just answer questions we put out a little basket or a bowl, and that usually gets things, started off. And but I was reflecting on one of my favorite short teachings of the Buddha, the Bade Karata Sutta. It's a very short teaching. And in the first half, there's the line that really stands out. And I tend to prefer the Ajahn Tanissero translation, but there's a line. Well, I'll just, maybe if I can remember the first half. You shouldn't chase after the past or place expectation on the future. The past is left behind. The future is as yet unreached. Whatever quality is present, you clearly see. Right there. Right there. Not taken in. Unshaken. That's how you develop the heart. And the line that, and there's another half, but I'll leave that for now. I'll probably bumble it anyway. I can't remember it so well. But the line that really stands out for me is that whatever quality is present, you clearly see. Right there, right there, not taken in, unshaken. So not taken in, unshaken. So if we have the wherewithal, the awareness, if we develop this consciousness, this mind, the mind that sees the mind, this is the way I reflect on it, the mind that sees the mind. So whatever quality is present, so the qualities come and go, objects coming in and out of awareness. So then not taken in. So, and you can reflect on that in many different ways, but to me it's okay, are we deluded by that quality? Are we deluded by that object? Do we take it personally? Is this my anger? Is this my joy? Am I born into that object? Am I boom, jati, birth? oh, I'm a joyful person, or whatever, I'm a such and such a person. Are we deluded by assuming it's a, you know, even though we hear teachings of impermanence, do we take it as being, oh, this is always going to be there? Are we deluded by thinking that it's satisfactory? Do we miss the opportunity to, or do we miss its dukkha-ness? It's not really a word, but do we miss that? Do we not see the unsatisfactory, stressful nature? Are we taken in? Are we fooled by that either thought or emotion or both, that experience? I guess Ajahn Chah was, one thing he would say is, you know, the mind is a liar. The mind is a liar. So to me, that's, yeah, not taken in. It's cutting to the chase. That's, you know, yeah, don't be taken in. The mind, the deluded grasping of what, of experience, of the things, the objects, grasping the objects or the activities of the mind. Not taken in, unshaken. Those two phrases, not taken in, unshaken. So there's the one of the translations, or you know, you hear this phrase in English, usually translated, and I don't know what the Thai is or the Pali, but unshakable peace, unshakable. So not taken in, unshaken. So the space, or that element, experience of peace that's not shaken by comfort, discomfort, joy, sorrow, whatever comes the way, not shaken by grasping at the good. Oh, everything's going my way, I got what I wanted. Or, oh, this is, I don't want this. Grasping at that, pushing it away, that's just, to me, another form of grasping. Grasping at the idea that when we get rid of that, then we'll be okay. When I get this, I'll be okay. And it's human enough. I mean, of course, you know, I want the good. I don't want the... But if we're pegging our overall well-being, our peace on things that are conditioned, conditions come and go. Conditions shake. They're shakeable, fragile. So we're building a house on a piece of ice in a climate that thaws out each year. Go to Canada or where these countries where they do ice fishing and they build these temporary huts on frozen lakes. And then, yeah, if you think you're going to live there for very long, yeah, you're building your house on something that's really shaky. Warm weather comes, boom. But to use words, even just in this Dhamma reflection, to use words to describe, to point, they can only really point to something that, as I said, it's a, for me, you know, it's a, this work in progress, you know, this, you know, reflecting. For me, using questioning, using, you know, picking out, maybe using language to reflect on the Buddha's teachings and the teachings that have been handed down to us since the Buddha was alive. Because to describe here again, to describe something that's this unconditioned, but you know, it's, you can only, the limits of language are just so obvious. Anyway, I think that's probably enough that I've said, but. Yeah, like I said, this is just sharing my ponderings, pretty much the main focus of my Dhamma efforts is asking these questions, is reflecting on the teachings that are handed down to us, and using every opportunity, every opportunity that we have. I know for me that I can't really plan these talks, and actually I find the shorter time of notice that I get, I don't know whether it makes a more useful talk, but it makes a more peaceful afternoon, that's for sure. But to use, for instance, the theme that came up for me when I was invited to give the talk was, oh, comfort, discomfort. Comfort, discomfort, because I'm not particularly comfortable giving a talk. But then I asked the question of myself, do I want to suffer over this? Choose. Like I said earlier, so ahimsako, choose. The choice is yours. You've spotted the discomfort. Now choose. And choosing doesn't necessarily mean do one or the other. You can choose to just, the mind seeing the mind, and let it fade away. It'll have its own life span. If I push or pull or grasp. So that's where the theme came from. It's not that you need to know where I get the theme. So I'll close this Dhamma reflection, and hopefully something's at least a little bit useful. And if not, then just leave it be.